It's a sultry Friday night, the 4th of July, 1947, in Hollister, California. Population 4,500. This normally quiet town, known for growing garlic, is thrumming with the sound of thousands of bikers revving engines as they roar into town and head for the bars. It's not long before a rowdy crowd spills out of the bars after having had a few too many, creating a drunken ruckus on Main Street. And that gets the attention of two journalists assigned to cover this gathering. They approach one of the bikers. It's Eddie Davenport, and he's leaning on his Harley and guzzling beer.
Excuse me, buddy. I'm J.C. Doty, San Francisco Chronicle. This is my photo man, Bob Peterson. Can we get a few shots of you on your, Harley Davidson?
Sure is. Snap away, boys.
Just to dress up the scene a bit for effect, the photographer adds a few more beer bottles before shooting.
So, how do I look?
Eddie's shirt is unbuttoned. His gut is hanging out. He hoists beers in both hands. He stares into the camera with the blank expression of a man best described as completely hammered. One of these photos is about to make Harley history. Hollister will be forever branded as the birthplace of the outlaw biker movement, and Harley Davidson will be the choice machine of these greasy, boozed-up degenerates.
You look swell, Eddie.
About 4,000 riders are here for a stop on the Gypsy Tour, a respectable social event sanctioned by the American Motorcycle Association. About 500 of those riders have no interest in a respectable social event. They're members of bike clubs with boozing and brawling on their singular agenda. The irony is that many of these alleged outlaws are World War II veterans, men who can't adjust to normal post-war life. They're looking for kicks, and they're finding them right here in this small California town. The Hollister event is a hot mess, but it's far from the hellish mayhem described in Doty's back page story. Riders steered their machines into bars, crashing into fixtures, furniture, bottles, and mirrors. They defied all traffic regulations, racing full speed through the streets and intersections. Right. There are actually only 59 arrests, mostly for drunk and disorderly conduct. A couple of bikers sustain minor injuries, but no civilians are hurt. And the town bars make more than $50,000. The event would have probably ended there if it had remained a local story. But when Life magazine runs the Davenport photo in late July, these rowdy hooligans horrify Americans, none more so than the law-abiding conservative executive of Harley Davidson.
Damn fools!
William Davidson slaps down a copy of Life magazine onto his desk in disgust, its pages open to the photos. He turns to his assistant and stabs his finger at the photo of Davenport.
Look at this drunken slob, sitting on one of our bikes. Why the hell would Life run something like this?
I guess it sells magazines, sir.
Well, I'm trying to sell motorcycles, not beat-up, stripped-down machines these punks can use to terrorize people.
This isn't the last time Davidson's temper is going to rise. Those vets looking for a good time will be overshadowed by serious outlaw Harley riders and cultural changes in America that will embrace all he despises. And there will be global challenges to a market he owns for now. Tools and Weapons is a podcast exploring the promise and the peril of the digital age, hosted by Microsoft's vice chair and president, Brad Smith. His latest guest is Bayer CEO Bill Anderson. Though many of us know Bayer for its pharmaceuticals, they're also focused on crop science with the goal of making sure no one on planet Earth goes hungry. On Tools and Weapons, Brad and Bill talk about how the German company is using artificial intelligence paired with CRISPR technology to increase food production without fertilizers. Their efforts put AI and digital tools in the hands of farmers to get the most out of every acre on a hotter, more crowded planet. It's the latest conversation in a series that invites listeners to pull up a front row seat to some of the most important developments in technology today. You can check out this episode and a whole lot more of Tools and Weapons with Brad Smith wherever you get your podcasts.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
From Wondery, I'm David Brown, and this is Business Wars.
Those of us who love to ride motorcycles often struggle to find the right words to explain our addiction to these machines. A lot of bikers wear a patch on their jackets that reads, "If I had to explain it, you wouldn't understand." If you do, well, you're in the club. Maybe that's one reason motorcyclists seem to travel in packs. We're a rather tribal bunch. There's also something addictive about the pulsing, offset rhythm of a twin-cylinder Harley engine, rumpity-thump, thump-thump, rumpity-thump, like an echo of a human heartbeat, the rumble becoming a roar with a twist of the wrist. If you know nothing else about bikes, you can close your eyes, and when I say the word motorcycle, it's likely the outline of a Harley that comes to mind, an American classic with a basic architecture that can be traced straight back to its roots in a Milwaukee bicycle shop of a century ago. Yet that bulky, timeless silhouette will also turn out to be Harley's Achilles heel. If you've got a need for speed, the visceral thrill of pushing the limits as the world turns into a blur, well, a Harley can feel like a tractor compared to the cutting-edge handling and refined performance of a lean machine like, say, the Kawasaki Ninja H2R or the Suzuki Hayabusa. Perhaps you prefer the old-world craftsmanship of a British-built Triumph or the Teutonic practicality of a BMW. There are others, of course, Ducatis, Indians, Hondas, more than just brands. Machines with a soul, reflections of their riders, extensions of ourselves. And for almost a century now, these iron horses have been battling it out on racetracks and roadways, hoping to earn our loyalty, a lasting place in our hearts and our garages. Motorcycles were barely a blip on the transportation scene in the U.S. in the early 20th century, but they've grown into a $90 billion global market. Harley-Davidson exists at the center of the story. It's managed to survive after so many challengers have died. As we begin this six-part series, Harley and the Biker Wars, hang on tight, because this ride could get wild real fast. This is Episode 1, The British Invaders. When America enters World War II in 1941, Harley-Davidson is conscripted to make 90,000 bikes for military service.
American motorcycle dispatch riders train on courses just as difficult as they will find soon in action, in Africa, in Alaska, in the South Pacific, or on the continent of Europe. For following these tests, they're off to battlefronts around the world.
In 42, Harley-Davidson issues a press release to loyal customers. Given the war effort, manufacturing will be cut back. It strikes just the right patriotic tone.
The Harley-Davidson you had hoped to ride is out at the front, helping to win the war. We know you are glad to forego your new dream motorcycle, so the brave lads in Uncle Sam's forces are equipped with the latest and the best.
During the war years, Harley-Davidson makes only a handful of motorcycles for civilians, though a trickle is better than nothing. The company doesn't make Indian's mistake. Indian devotes all its resources to the war, leaving domestic consumers high and dry. By 1947, American GIs are back. Jobs are plentiful, the economy is booming, and folks have money to spend. It's time for Harley-Davidson to kickstart production. William H. Davidson, a savvy, tough boss, understands after the devastating war, people are looking for a good time.
He's learned that trying to sell people on the motorcycle as a utility vehicle is a lot harder than selling a mighty Harley as an instrument of pleasure. Nobody actually needs a motorcycle, so Davidson has to make them want one. And he knows exactly who he has to persuade first. During the 1947 National Dealers Conference in Milwaukee, he organizes an event for the dealers with a kind of secrecy typically reserved for a military special ops briefing. On November 24th, representatives from about 800 Harley-Davidson dealers from around the country arrive. On a freezing night, they're bundled onto railway cars headed for, well, they have no idea where they're going. 8 miles later, they find out. The train stops at the city of Wauwatosa. A couple of Harley dealers step off the train into the frigid cold as a light snow dusts the platform. Their collars are up, their shoulders hunched, and their breath comes out in gusts of condensation.
Any idea what Davidson's got up his sleeve?
Nope. I just hope we're going someplace warm.
Finally, the group arrives at their mysterious location, a massive, spanking new Harley-Davidson manufacturing center. 400,000 square feet spread over almost 22 acres. It cost over $1.5 million to build. The company's been doing well. Davidson ushers the group in. They look around, astonished at the sheer size of the operation.
Gentlemen, welcome to the Harley-Davidson world of tomorrow. As many of you know, I've been talking about the future a lot lately, about a far-reaching expansion program to keep Harley-Davidson in the lead. Now you see with your own eyes that we mean business.
It is an impressive sight. Everything looks state-of-the-art.
This place looks amazing, but what exactly have you got planned for us? A brand new factory should make a brand new bike.
Right, yeah.
Exactly.
Davidson's going to do just that. He has to. He's well aware that the British are coming, and they're bringing bikes that are fast, lightweight, and easy to handle. Basically, the opposite of the massive Harley hogs. British imports, like Norton, BSA, and Triumph, are attracting younger buyers who can't afford an $800-plus Harley.
Gentlemen, Harley-Davidson is known for creating the ultimate cruising motorcycles. They're big, they're strong, and no one can beat them. Though a few folks overseas have tried. Tonight, you're the first to see something completely different. It's what many of you have been asking for.
Davidson gives a nod, and two attendants pull off the cover, unveiling the new bike. It's low-slung, sleek, and simple. The gas tank is painted gleaming black with Harley-Davidson emblazoned in red on the side. It's a bike even a mother could love. And for a Harley, it's downright cute.
She's a beaut, eh? It's the single-cylinder, three-horsepower S125 model. Only weighs 170 pounds, and she tops out at a safe, user-friendly speed of 45 miles per hour. And the price tag is under $300. Your young customers are going to like that. Step up and get a closer look.
The franchise owners move in and surround the small bike. Two dealers stand back and take it all in.
It's impressive. Can't wait to get it in the showroom back in Florida. You know, I think Bill's right. Teenagers, old folks, heck, even women can ride this thing.
Few women ride motorcycles, but the S125 could change that. The perky bike impresses the dealers, but in truth, it has a foreign pedigree. When the war ended, the Allied nations divided up all sorts of Nazi Germany's intellectual property. That included blueprints for a bike created in Germany in 1919, the DKW RT125. It's an efficient two-stroke motorcycle called Das Kleine Wunder, or the Little Marvel. Americans confiscated the design and handed it over to the biggest American motorcycle company. The dealers are now hovering over its revamped clone. The bike becomes available just in time for Christmas, and it's a smart move. It'll account for a third of the year's sales. But Harley's bread and butter is still its hulking high-horsepower cruising machine.
Since the late 1930s, the company's biggest calling card has been the first mass-produced superbike on the planet, the Rumbling Knucklehead, nicknamed for its distinct two-cylinder engine with two knuckle-like bolts sticking out. Over the years, Harley-Davidson V-twin engines all carry affectionate pet names based on unique mechanical styling: flathead, knucklehead, panhead, and shovelhead. If you didn't know better, you'd think a couple of serious mechanics discussing internal combustion engines were talking about half-wit cartoon characters. But in 1948, the newly debuted panhead is no joke. And it's got a spine-shattering 50 horsepower engine to prove it. It's the fastest, most powerful cruising bike available in North America. It's massively popular. And at 565 pounds, it's the heftiest hog on the road. In 1948, the company sets a new peacetime sales record. Harley owns the market in the U.S., selling close to 30,000 bikes, while British imports trail at around 5,000. Meanwhile, things are looking increasingly grim for Harley's only American longtime rival, Indian Motorcycle Company. It's in a slow but steady financial tailspin toward bankruptcy. But the Harley-Davidson Brain Trust has got their eyes on the foreign threat. Bill Davidson sends a staffer to the 1949 London Motorcycle Show to do a little reconnaissance. When the staffer returns, he immediately gives Davidson a debriefing.
BSA, Norton, Triumph, they're all hot to divide up the American market, and it seems they have no choice. The theme of the show was export or die.
Davidson is absorbing this as his staffer continues.
The government is short on raw materials, so they're making their companies guarantee 75% of production abroad before they'll give them the materials to build more bikes.
It gets worse. Because the British devalued their currency, they're an even cheaper competitor. And Brits are begging for work and willing to accept lower wages than American workers. Harley takes action. But the kind of action is more in line with mob practices than an all-American business. If a Harley leadership sells anything, even down to a can of oil that doesn't bear the Harley imprint, they're cut off. And God forbid a dealer offers a foreign-made bike. Eventually, these strong-arm tactics get the attention of the feds. In September 1949, the Federal Trade Commission charges Harley-Davidson with monopolistic practices. The FTC accuses the company of using intimidation and coercion to force some 700 dealerships to do business exclusively with Harley. That means dealers can't sell anything that doesn't have the Harley-Davidson name on it. The FTC forces Harley to back off, giving British bikes an opening. Soon, motorcycles are Britain's third largest export after cars and whiskey. Harley sales are down by half. What seemed like a manageable challenge has become a serious threat. Bill Davidson knows he has to do something to save the company, so he resorts to a desperate move, one that will shock the motorcycle world. You know, Audible has a brand new collection of exclusive thrillers. Every move is made more exciting by captivating sound design, eerie soundscapes, and dynamic performances. I just downloaded The Grand Opening by Carl Weber. It's a mystery about a family business in a small southern town, and there are secrets around every turn. You know, when I'm listening, the time just disappears, getting completely immersed in the story and the performances. And as an Audible member, you get to keep one title a month from their entire catalog, including bestsellers and new releases. So come on, listen along. New members can try Audible now free for 30 days. Head on over to audible.com/BW or just text BW to 500-500. That's audible.com/BW or text BW to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. As business owners and managers, you use software for your business every day. You use one piece of software to manage your customers, another to manage your employees, another to manage your finances, and the list goes on. You buy these pieces independently and hope they fit neatly together like a puzzle. And then you find out the hard way that they don't, and you end up with a mess at the heart of your business operations. Does any of this sound familiar? Well, fortunately, Zoho offers a solution to this chaos. It's called Zoho One.
Zoho One is a suite of around 50 pre-integrated business applications that fit together beautifully. So instead of dealing with disparate software from multiple vendors with multiple contracts and price points, you deal with one vendor with all the pieces of the business software puzzle neatly put together, offered at a very attractive price. Now, if this sounds interesting to you, you got to check out Zoho One at zoho.one. That's ZOHO.ONE. With Zoho, you're not just licensing apps. You're licensing peace of mind.
It's 1949. Edward Turner is on one of his regular trips to the States, driving a car from New York to the motorcycle races in Daytona Beach. Turner's the reason Triumph motorcycles are in America. He's the Englishman behind the company's dedicated invasion, but he's more than just a savvy businessman. He's a gifted designer, an engineer, considered by many the Frank Lloyd Wright of the bike world. He loves to ride, and he loves America. On this trip to Florida, Turner's buddy Rod Coates is riding shotgun with him.
So, Ed, word is you're working on a new bike, something very special just for us Yanks.
Indeed I am. It's a four-stroke engine, 650 cc's. All the horsepower any law-abiding American needs to outrun the police.
So, what are you calling it?
Not sure. Haven't come up with anything just yet. Say, see that motel over there? Interesting name, eh?
Thunderbird Motel? Sure. Yeah, I guess so.
Thunderbird. I like the sound of that.
The name sticks. The bike makes its debut in 1949, and it catches on fast. It's almost 200 pounds lighter than Harley's 560-pound FL-1200 knucklehead, but every bit as powerful. On the business side, Turner is the driving force behind the U.S.-based Triumph Corporation, which sets up shop in Baltimore in January of 1951. At this point, more Triumphs are being sold in America than Britain or anywhere else in the world. And the success goes beyond the showroom.
At Daytona Beach, Florida, 111 get away for the start of the 200-mile AMA Motorcycle Classic, one of the world's most dangerous races. As Norton's and Triumph's filled the first six places, it was a sweeping victory for British machines.
It's all bloody good news for Triumph, and rider Bobby Turner sets a speed record of 132 miles per hour on his Thunderbird. The UK company is making headlines. The suits in Milwaukee are fed up. Bill Davidson plans a counterattack, and he enlists the help of the United States government. In June of 51, Harley approaches the U.S. Tariff Commission, claiming that English motorcycles are attempting to put Harley out of business. Their moderately priced machines cost a third less than Harley's. That's the sum of their lame defense. The Triumphs are much cheaper. Harley asks the commission to ensure the number of British bikes imported to the U.S. does not exceed more than 10% of all American-made bikes. Considering that Harley produces virtually all of the bikes made in the U.S. at this point, it's obvious the demand is self-serving. The U.S. Senate calls for hearings. Harley-Davidson's lawyers arrive with three longtime dealers who lay out their sob story of being so unfairly undercut. Then, it's the British importers' turn. Triumph's brought along a dozen dealer and sales reps from domestic manufacturers, Indian and Mustang. But the most powerful testimony comes from a former Harley employee, Alfred Rich Child. Child is a dapper Englishman who single-handedly established Harley's strong markets in Africa and the Far East. In 1921, he rode a Harley from Cape Town to Cairo, setting up dealerships along the way. Now Child imports English-made BSA bikes, but he knows a lot about Harley-Davidson, his previous employer, and he's happy to spill his thoughts in Washington.
Mr. Child, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Senator. I'll get right to the point. Harley-Davidson makes a fine motorcycle, but they're no strangers to price-fixing. They've threatened and manipulated dealers, all with the singular goal of creating a monopoly in the motorcycle industry.
Child sits motionless, waiting for the crowd to simmer down.
Anything else, Mr. Child?
Oh, yes, sir. Harley Davidson insists customers are buying British motorcycles simply because they're less expensive. In fact, Harley's market share is slipping because Harley isn't making motorcycles that the public wants. In fact, people are buying British motorcycles because they're just as good, if not better, than what's being manufactured in Milwaukee. We have a few examples for you.
Child gestures to the back of the hearing room. A Triumph and other UK bikes are wheeled up front and center in the Senate chambers. Committee members lean in for a closer look at the gleaming machines. Harley's aware that all parties are bringing examples of their handiwork, and they provide a hulking example of their own from Milwaukee, assuming it will be met with nothing less than admiration. They're wrong. A senator takes a close look at it.
So that's the Harley, eh? Must weigh a ton.
Child is not done.
I'd like to point out that it's the only bike that had to be taken apart to fit into the elevator.
Members of the tariff board are at the Senate hearing. The board comes to a decision. It resoundingly rejects Harley's request for a duty increase. The subtext is loud and clear. Stop whining. Build smaller bikes. Learn how to compete with the foreign imports. The British are gleeful, especially Triumph. Harley-Davidson has been sandbagged for now, but it's still the biggest motorcycle company in the United States. It still has some fight left, and it's going to need it. The war is just beginning, and it has battlefronts no one in Milwaukee ever dreamed of. On the next episode, Harley will have its hands full not just with domestic competition, but with British Triumph, which wants nothing less than total market domination in the 1950s. And Harley's chief will agonize as bike gangs rev up to take the Harley name on a long, dark, deadly ride.
Hey, Prime members, you can binge every episode of Business Wars ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
From Wondery, this is Business Wars. We hope you enjoyed this episode. I'm your host, David Brown. Peter Gilstrap wrote this story. Karen Lowe is our senior producer and editor. Our editor and producer is Jenny Lauer Beckman. Sound design by Bay Area Sound. Our executive producer is Marshall Louie, created by Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Murder on My Mind, a new podcast available exclusively on Wondery Plus, explores the circumstances leading up to the murder of two young men and the mistrials of the man accused of killing them. Up-and-coming rapper YNW Melly gained notoriety in the hip-hop world for his shocking lyrics and criminal exploits. When two of his best friends were gunned down in a drive-by shooting, investigators suspected the young rapper staged the scene. But after not one, but two trials that ended in hung juries and new evidence that may place YNW Melly at the scene of the crime, his trial has been paused indefinitely. With countless twists and turns, Law & Crime covers all angles of the case and begs the question, is this young artist the victim of a witch hunt or a silver-tongued devil who's evil to the core? Listen to Murder on My Mind exclusively and ad-free on Wondery Plus. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.